Welcome, everyone.
Well, there goes.
This is the session on Right Haven, which is we all agreed up here is the next business model that we plan to follow, because there's one estimate that Right Haven has made about $300,000, I think. I saw somebody that had estimated that based on the number of suits they've filed, the number of settlements and dismissals they've voluntarily entered into.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think I saw that on righthavenlawsuits.com.
Oh, yes, yes, there is. Does everybody know what a patent troll is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, is anybody in here a patent troll?
Yeah, a normal troll. Right Haven is a copyright troll, or has been alleged to be a copyright troll, or characterized as a copyright troll. Got to be careful, because, you know, they have a tendency to sue people.
Right. Purportedly.
Yeah, right.
Hey, you haven't put anything in print yet, so.
Well, I had their website logo. I mean, I'm really tempting fate. Come on back. There it is. Ah, well.
Don't put it on a blog.
Yeah, that is actually the Right Haven, their own webpage where they preach about how wonderful it is what they do. It's a JPEG or a GIF or something, and I'm sure that they don't want you to copy it and republish it anywhere, as I have just done. But it's fair use, which Right Haven doesn't seem to understand the concept of.
Right.
But I guess let me give a little background, and then I'll stop talking. Let these guys talk, Tom. Right Haven was apparently started by a newspaper publisher in Las Vegas who got pissed off that the newspaper business is dying. And so he wanted to take it out on somebody, and he decided the best target was the bloggers in probably the Nevada, Las Vegas area who republish articles or excerpts of articles that appear in his newspaper. And I can't remember, there are two big newspapers in Las Vegas. And is it the Sun?
Las Vegas Review.
These are the bad guys. The Sun is the good guys on the other side who criticize the Review for what they're doing. But anyway, he got together with a lawyer from a fairly big nationwide law firm, a lot of lawyers, and they created a limited liability company where the newspaper would assign a real strange kind of right to this limited liability company to permit them to sue for past infringement. And so they started filing lawsuits, or threatening lawsuits, excuse me. They did file a lot of lawsuits too, but they threatened lawsuits in order to drive these bloggers to settle. And it's very similar to what the recording industry did to people that downloaded music, although the big difference in scale is the recording industry went after people who posted it on, made it available through BitTorrent and other means where lots of people were copying it. Whereas these guys just had a little website, and they're, you know, talking about whatever little feature that they were interested in. There was one that was I read about that did was interested in motorcycles, and they did something about the Hells Angels or police impersonating Hells Angels or something strange. And so they just excerpted something from the newspaper, and that got them served with a lawsuit. What Right Haven was able to do was to threaten these people who may not have a lot of resources, may not have a lot of legal knowledge, may not have any legal resources, and threaten them with something that would be so expensive for them that, which we can all attest to, anytime you get lawyers or law firms involved, it's real expensive real quick, to threaten them and drive them to settle for a couple $1,000s. They asked for $75,000 and the domain names of any of these sites that were being posted, but they'd settle for a couple $1,000s. Anyway, that's sort of the intro to... by the way, my name is Paul Toppins. I'm a lawyer in Alabama, and this is...
TJ Myhill. I'm a lawyer here in Atlanta.
This is...
Cara Mikus. I'm a litigation paralegal.
And we all love all these nerdy stuff like this. Anyway, anybody else want to...
No, we just love a good fight.
Right. Yeah. Well, the problem with something like Right Haven, and I do copyright litigation. I'm a litigator, so I go to court. When you get the when you get the notice or you get the summons that you've been sued, I'm the guy you call, and I'm the guy who tells you that you need to mortgage your house if you want to be able to actually fight this, because copyright litigation is pretty expensive.
Unlike every other kind of litigation.
Right, no, all the rest are cheap. The problem that people have is everyone comes in and says, but it's a fair use. Even if you're right. And you just say you're right. In this case, they're almost certainly right. Everything that I've read about from Right Haven, I can't see how any court in the country wouldn't find at least 90% of them to be a fair use. But that's what has to happen. The court has to find that it's a fair use. That means you go through the entire litigation process. You go through all the discovery. You spend your tens of thousands of dollars to get to trial. You have a trial. The court determines that this is fair use. Maybe you can shortcut it with a motion for summary judgment somewhere along the way that it's fair use, but that's still going to be, practically, after all of the initial legwork and discovery is done. So the problem with a fair use defense is that it's a defense that you raise in court by spending a whole lot of money.
But as a business plan, Right Haven was very well done, although not well thought out.
How are executed.
Right. Right. The big difference between the RIAA suits that were mentioned and the Right Haven issue is that the RIAA actually had the right to sue legally over these issues. Right Haven, as it turns out, not so much.
Yeah, copyright law, which in a nutshell is the right to make copies. That's basically, if you want to boil it all down. Copyright law has a, what they call, or the law professors like to say, is a bundle of rights that are covered by that. Certain things that you, as the copyright holder, the creator or the owner of the copyright, depending on the circumstances, can do. You can make copies. You can make derivative works. You can make, you know, Superman 2, Superman 3. Those are derivative works of Superman. There are a lot of rights. I can't remember.
But you can't make a profit, though. That was the big thing that I think I'm seeing in what's going on in court right now. If you take someone's work and you publish it somewhere, you need to be doing it for whatever legitimate reason, profit not being that reason. One specific case, and this is the one I think that I showed you the order on, was the Tea Party case. Yeah, Democratic Underground.
Yeah.
They posted something out of the Denver Post on their website. And the Denver Post, being one of the newspapers that is tied up in this nice little scheme, they planted a Trojan, whatever that thing is, sorry, not being terribly computer savvy, in there. And when somebody copied and went to paste it onto their website, it went back to the Denver Post and said, aha, now we've got one. And that's what started that lawsuit. So, yeah, but they did it not for profit. They did it purely for informative reasons.
Fair use, which I'm trying to, I apologize, I don't have all this stuff, you know, right at the hand like I should, but fair use is a notion in copyright law that developed primarily through the courts, as I understand it, where somebody would do something, because technically you make a copy of something, you've broken the copyright of somebody else's work, somebody else that holds the copyright. You've broken the law that they have the absolute right to make copies of their own work, sell them, do whatever they want with them. You make a copy, but make a Xerox of it or do something like that, do something else. That's probably dated these days. Probably you would say you make a scan of it, you know, shows how old I am. But you make a mimeograph of the thing, and you...
Is that with that old onion skin paper?
it's
even worse.
You recarve it into a stone tablet.
You violated their copyright. And at some point, court, when people would say, come in and sue people for that, they'd come in and say, on the basis of the facts, it's just not equitable to hold somebody liable for a de minimis kind of use like that. And so they came up with all these factors. And when the copyright code was redone in 1976, I believe, some of the major factors that the courts had been using were incorporated into the statute, which is at 115. And there basically are four. which I can't find right here. There are basically four factors they list. One is the purpose and character of the use. What are you using the thing that you're using? That somebody else's. Thank you. Thank you. What is the nature of the copyrighted work? Is it something that's meant to be sold to make income for the copyright creator, the copyright holder? Is it something that, you know, is done on a, you know, on a non-profit basis? Just the nature of the work. Then the third factor, the amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole. If you take a little bit, that's probably you're gonna meet the fair use factor. It'll help. If you take the whole damn thing and preprint the whole article, that goes to that element, and you have a little bit more problem. But then the fourth one, the effect of the use upon the potential market for or the value of the copyrighted work. It's doubtful that in some of these Righthaven cases, these bloggers or whoever it is, somebody on, you know, I wouldn't name some of them are bloggers, they're just people that had a web page and they saw something interesting in the paper and they put it on. It's doubtful that the fact that they published it, put it in there, hurt the business of these newspapers. In fact, you know, a lot of folks who are trying to come up with new models of income for the newspaper world. And I hope they do. I mean, we have newspapers have to survive. We have our news sources have to survive, or we're in a lot of trouble. It's doubtful it would hurt they would not sell as many papers because of it. The decline in newspaper sales, I think, is a separate, it's related, but it's not something you can pin on some guy that posts an excerpt.
It's because we've all gone green.
Yeah, right, yeah. You look at those factors, the courts look at those factors, they weigh some other things too, they throw up in the mix, and if you meet the test, because it's an amorphous thing, you know, how much is too much to take? Righthaven at one point said, we're not going to go after anybody unless they use over 75% of what we have published. You know, if they excerpt more than 75%, we'll still bring those lawsuits. And they made this representation to a judge in one of the cases where they're getting slapped down for what they've done. Because there was one where they'd taken, I think it was four paragraphs out of a 34-paragraph article, and they brought a lawsuit, and the district court judge, the federal district court judge in Nevada was... they'd gotten tired of Righthaven, first of all, because they filed lots of lawsuits, and they'd made some misrepresentations to the court, and they hadn't been clear about the rights that they actually did have from this agreement they had with this newspaper publisher. Any event, 4 out of 34 on something where you're not making, you may be making a lot of income from, that's, I'd take that case. I'd argue that's a fair use.
I was just kind of thinking on the flip side of that, when you're talking about where if there's a certain amount of content or money at the end result, the Drudge Report was sued by Righthaven. You guys all know who the Drudge Report is. Okay, so they were sued by Righthaven, and Righthaven asserted in its complaint that they wanted to seize its domain name. As a result of the lawsuit, they wanted that to be one of their requests for relief granted. And that domain name is worth millions. You know, wouldn't you like to be able to sue somebody for taking two or three sentences and you get $1 million domain name? Sweet.
And in fact, the Drudge Report, I think that Drudge posted a picture that was in the court file, not a picture from the newspaper. So it wasn't even, it was a step removed from being, a pure taking it directly from, you know, it was a public record. It was in the court file. At some point, Righthaven, and let me switch to this. Said they weren't going to bring lawsuits anymore for written infringement, one of their many things. They've changed their mind a lot of times, but they were just going to do it for images. And so they came after a bunch of people for a hotel or an office tower in Las Vegas that's very mirrored, and it hits, the sunlight hits it, it shoots it into some swimming pool at a hotel nearby and boils the water. You know, just fries everybody because it's it hits it. And they had this picture of it. Oh, by the way, this is the guy that the newspaper, Steve Gibson, I think is his name. Not the good Steve Gibson, but the bad Steve Gibson. Oh, hell. And...
It is Gibson.
Yeah. Hold on. Ah, probably. Ah, there it is. That's the image that they brought against some people. There was a... And I can't remember the name of the tower, but then they put it in the newspaper, a graphic. And so some people were writing about it and had, you know, reproduced the graphic, which... You know, it's the whole thing. It's the whole graphic. It's not the whole article, but...
The Wynn Hotel?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what it is.
What was the question?
It was at the Wynn Hotel is what the question?
Yeah, in Vegas.
I attribute Wright Haven's success to partially to this guy, or the idea for this business model, because what... at least what I was taught copyright law, but my professor said, you know, what's driving all this is the increase in penalties, because it didn't used to be, the penalties can be up to $150,000 plus attorney's fees depending on the right set of circumstances for an infringement. It used to be much, much lower, but what was driving it was things like the motion picture industry and Disney and the recording industry, that saw their valuable copyrights being threatened. Mickey is responsible for the reason why copyright laws, partially responsible. Copyright laws extend now for 150 years, or, you know, the life of a person plus 70, I think, is it?
75.
Just really long time. Copyright used to be 12 or 13 years and you had a renewal period, and then it was 27 or 35 years. I don't remember all the numbers, but it just keeps inching up. And so it means that things that every time Mickey gets set to go into the public domain, Congress ups the time the amount, and so he stays out of the public domain, and you know he's still there for Disney to exploit. But to catch the kind of counterfeiters and people that were hurting the big guys, they wanted the penalties to be increased so that it would be a real deterrent. Trouble is, you got the little guys. That get caught by these trolls who say, hey, this is a sure thing. We can go in there, and if they've infringed, and we can show they've infringed, we could hit them up for enormous damages. Now, they won't be able to probably pay it, but if we do this enough, we can drive enough business to make some money off of this.
And the real money maker isn't getting the suits, because if you go in, you get the suit, you're paying your attorneys to bring that suit too. It's no cheaper to bring a copyright litigation than it is to defend one. So most of the people who are bringing these demands to the table, they don't want to actually go to court. Wright Haven would rather be out of court. They don't really want to be in court as much as they are, for one reason, because they keep getting slapped down by judges every time they go in there. So they would rather get the little guys and force settlements for a couple of thousand dollars, because if I can send a letter and you send me $5,000, I'm doing pretty well.
Yep.
So what you have is a business model that really came out of the RIAA, then the MPAA picked it up, and now Wright Haven figures it's good enough for them, it's good enough for newspapers. We've got a serious risk involved. You may or may not have actually downloaded some of our content, whether it be music or movies or whatever. But I'm going to send a demand that says I'm going to drag you into court. You had to prove yourself that you didn't, because I'm going to show whatever evidence I have that says you did. And the court's going to decide, maybe you win, maybe you don't. But at the end of the day, if you don't, I get $150,000 per infringement is the demand I'm making on you. And you've spent all those attorney's fees, and you got to pay all my attorney's fees. So maybe you should just cut me a check for $3,500 or $5,000 or $7,500 or whatever it is I think you can afford. And there are a lot of people who will do that. And there are a lot of people who will do that because then when they bring that letter in to me and I say, yes, I'll be glad to take your case. My initial retainer is $7,500. And they say they only want $5,000. Well, Yeah, that's the way it works. It's extortion. It's 100% blackmail, but it's effective blackmail, and they're making a lot of money off of it. Because the risk is there. There really is some copyright infringement going on. Maybe it's fair use, maybe it's not, but you've got to go and put all those chips on the table and pay for the legal defense to show that. So it turns out to be a lot cheaper for most people to just kind of pay the extortion than to bring the suit. And that's how the RIAA and the MPAA and Right Haven were making money. Now, Right Haven took the poorly thought out decision of going ahead and suing people over it, and has been found to not have a very viable business model after all, because it turned out to not have standing. The agreement that it got didn't actually convey any copyright ownership. It just conveyed the right to sue, and that's not legitimate standing. In court, you've got to have standing. That means I'm a proper party to bring this claim. And the proper party to bring a copyright claim is the owner of the copyright rights, the person who has the right to reproduce the work, to make derivative works, etc. Right Haven has none of those rights. Right Haven was not assigned any of the rights to use the stories or the images. Right Haven simply got the right to get half the profits upon suing and bring suit on behalf of Stevens Media and others. So
that bundle of rights just that I mentioned earlier, I realized I didn't connect that thought. The court that looked at it said the bundle of rights, you have to have at least one stick out of that bundle of rights, of copyright rights, and the right to bring a lawsuit alone, not the right to do anything else with the copyrighted work, isn't enough. You have to have the right to be able to use the work. And so the Right Haven didn't have that because the guy that published the newspapers didn't want to give this limited liability company any of those rights.
But now if they want to fix it, all they have to do is assign one of those rights and Right Haven's back.
They did. They actually came up with they amended their agreement. I'm sorry. amended their agreement and had it so that they transferred the rights, but that Right Haven had to give them notice, the owners of the original owners of the copyright, notice that it was going to use some of those rights, which they could then pull back. Had to give 30 days notice. And the court looked at that and said, this is a sham. You know, you only pretended to give them the rights, but if they ever try to exercise the rights, meaning publish something, you know, themselves with that work, that they would they'd likely pull it back. And so it didn't. It wasn't happy with that.
What was the intended perceived benefit to Right Haven by pursuing that business model versus a traditional representative relationship of attorney-client with the rights holders?
Well, the situation with Right Haven is we've created a whole new company which is going to sue on our behalf. Stevens Media, who is the newspaper company that started it, is in the newspaper business. They're not in the lawsuit business. So they created a partnership with a law firm, basically, who's in the lawsuit business, and agreed to share the proceeds 50-50. You use our property and your litigation efforts, we'll keep making content. We don't have to worry about proceeding with lawsuits. You proceed with the lawsuits, which is what you do day in and day out. With our content, we'll all make some money.
Yeah, I'm sure that it started with the guy, the publisher, sitting around at his country club with a lawyer.
Thought, this is going to be good.
Yeah. and he's bitching about the newspaper industry and how people are just stealing his content, which I can sympathize a little bit, or a lot, you know, sympathize. And he's just bitching about it, and the lawyer who's got some hotshot, clever lawyer says, you know, the penalties for copyright violation are so huge, and we can actually get attorney's fees sometimes. I bet we could threaten some of these people that just wholesale copy your stuff and actually make money off of it. And the guy said, well, I don't want to pay you. I don't want to hire you as my lawyer and have to pay you hourly rates. You set it up. You do it. Tell me what to do. I'll do it. And we'll split the profits. So, yes.
Well, my question was, what made them think they were going to get away with that scheme that you just?
I think they could get away with it. I don't think it's. They did some things wrong. They said, you know, their execution wasn't great, but they're working on it. I don't think they're going away.
Right.
I think that knowing how the legal business works, not present company excluded, of course, but some lawyer somewhere is going to see this and say, so he understands copyright. It's going to take them a little bit of having to know a little knowledge, and they'll go, wait a minute. You mean that if I go to all the newspapers in Georgia and Alabama and Florida, and I say, look, let's make a deal, I can sue the people that are just posting your newspaper articles en masse on their websites and getting Google AdWords, you know, AdSense money, and you're not making any income from it, but we could get them to A, stop it, or B, make some money from it. I think we're going to see more of it. Right Haven sort of led the way and showed how to do it wrong, but I think they can fix it. Problems can be fixed.
And the other thing is, I mean, I think Right Haven did a pretty good job. They're $300,000 better off than they were before they started it, and they weren't even doing it properly.
Yeah.
So the business model, like I said, RIAA proved this works. The copyright extortion. Can you tell I'm a fan? the extortion tactics that are being used are simply good business. They're very profitable. I'll settle for a lot less than it will cost to defend a suit, and I'll get a whole lot more than I would have got if you just bought an album. So it's frankly pretty good profit for the industries involved. It doesn't make it proper in my mind, but it's profitable.
It wasn't the intent, I think, behind, you know, the real intent behind copyright infringement laws. Of course, copyright laws changed so much. The idea, it's in the Constitution, you know, to it, and I can't remember the right words, but it's to encourage the
to
creation.
Promote the progress of science and the useful arts by securing for their authors for limited times.
Very good.
I think that Right Haven's major flaw with their initial business plan was that within their contract that they wrote with Stevens Media, they basically said exactly that, the 50% issue, and that was the only reason they had any right to sue, which then they'd signed a contingency fee agreement and nothing more, and that's what the courts are finding. The remedy to that is changing their initial contract. Now, does it go back and change things for the 375 lawsuits that they'd filed prior to that? According to the most recent ruling, no. They can't rely on that change. But will it change things for a lawsuit filed tomorrow and by a new Right Haven? Probably.
The EFF, not this EAFF, which you're probably infringing on their trademark, but the other EAFF, the big guy, what are the Electronic Freedom
Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Thank you. Those guys are stepping in to try to help out these Right Haven victims. But the things I've read is, I don't know if they've taken any of the cases, they're trying to find them lawyers, but they basically said they were up to, one quote was, they were up to our armpits in lawsuits. It just overwhelms them. There's so many. You know, from the defense standpoint, trying to help out guys that are for this $2,000 a pop or $3,000 to settle is still an expensive proposition. So there's some webpage, somebody's, the righthavenlawsuits.org or whatever, has something about some law firm trying to get together a class action to sue Right Haven for some violations, but I think this is...
You had a question?
No,
sorry.
Wait, it's maybe going.
Sorry.
I mean, I hear the word extortion getting thrown around a lot up there, and that is a criminal offense, if I'm not mistaken. You guys are the lawyers. But has anybody been criminally charged with that?
It's legal extortion.
Right. The problem is...
Extortion, loose quotes
right.
around it.
I'm using it because that's basically what it comes down to, is I'm threatening you with litigation that will cost you
more.
Everything you own, or you pay me some small amount. Now, will I win that litigation? That's iffy. But I'm pretty well guaranteed to get that small settlement that I'm looking for. The reason that it's legal is that, well, the reason that it's legal for the RIAA or the MPAA is that they own the rights. They have the right to the music. The music is being downloaded. They have the right to the movie. The movie is being downloaded. As a practical matter, while I won't discuss the guilt or innocence of any of the people who have come to represent me for legal, there are a lot of things that get downloaded. And as a practical matter, that is 100% copyright infringement. Regardless of what we may personally think about it, regardless of how we may personally view the ethical implications or the financial implications or any of the other things that people are arguing about in a philosophical bent, legally that's copyright infringement, unquestionably. You get before a judge, you'll lose. And so the question is, are you going to lose $25,000 or $35,000 or $100,000, or are you going to pay the $5,000? They're never going to get a judgment. They probably would never sue you. It would cost them more than it's worth to sue. So that's why I call it extortion. The idea that I'm going to force you to pay me this settlement to avoid the ongoing litigation in some areas where maybe I don't have the most clear-cut case against you. Maybe I can't really say you personally downloaded this song as opposed to a song was downloaded in your vicinity. That's the kind of thing where paying a judgment because I can't afford to defend myself. Maybe it's fair use. It's absolutely fair use, but you don't have the financial means to pay to bring that fair use defense into court, which is where it has to go. Then it doesn't matter that it was fair use. You can't afford to raise that defense. You're going to pay the $5,000 for copyright infringement settlement when you didn't really infringe a copyright. So that's what the problem is. But those are all gray areas. Those are all things the court has to decide. So legally, there's copyright infringement. Legally, you're settling a valid or potentially valid copyright claim.
Is there any group or maybe any specific politician that are trying to lobby or present legislation to patch the copyright laws by adding like a de minimis exception or something like that for the small time non-commercial, you know, downloader, or is that just never going to happen?
Never going to happen.
I mean, the problem is you'd have too much abuse of that system.
There's a fair use provision in the copyright code. That's what Mickey will say. You know, gee, there's a fair use provision. You don't need to use my Mickey impression. Sorry. We don't need something. There are something already there that they can go to. You know, that they tell the folks in Congress on the right committees. Of course, it costs a fortune for them to avail themselves of that. They have to have some legal experience or ability, or, you know, it has to be a Grok law started to deal with that. For those of you familiar with the SCO case with dealing with Unix, Linux, excuse me. Yeah.
I have a question. It's related, but if it's too far off, maybe you can tell me what session to ask it in. When I go to a website that's not behind a paywall, let's say a newspaper, and I see the ads, I've never understood whether those ads come from the newspaper or from the search engine that I have, which is Google, even though I went directly to the website. My question is there any legal problem with the whoever it is taking out the ads that the publisher provided and sticking their own ads in, because it seems like it removes some source of income that the publisher would get?
I'd say yeah.
Well, I think if you're removing the ads, yeah, I think there'd certainly be a problem. I would be surprised, and I'm not a technology guy, despite my entire legal career revolving around technology. I would be very surprised if they are removing ads and not just inserting ads in an area where there were none. If they're there by the publisher, or they're there by Google, or they're there by Yahoo or whoever, they're probably just inserted at the, you know, at the benefit of the newspaper. There's probably a profit sharing arrangement to put those ads up there, pay per click type arrangement, and very likely they're there not in place of something the publisher had originally run, but rather just as a new ad on the website.
So I have heard, but I don't know a lot about this subject specifically, but that if someone files you for copyright infringement and you do take it to court and you do prove that it was false and they knew that it was false, that you can get recovery beyond just your lawyer's fees. Is there any possibility, if there were some way to take advantage of that, maybe you could pick up the stronger cases and maybe pay for the legal fees, but then get some money out of, not only did we get paid back the legal fees for winning, but we can get some recovery from the fact that it was a false copyright infringement claim.
Well, there are ways that you can bring additional claims beyond just your attorney's fees. Defamation might be one of them, or any number of other claims that you can add in to a counterclaim on this suit. The challenge is that, again, you still have to bring those in court and be successful. And two, once you bring those in court, you are successful, you get awarded your attorney's fees. As a practical matter, an award of attorney's fees does not mean you got back what you spent. It means you get some random number the judge made up that he felt was a fair number, and it's not going to be anywhere near what you actually incurred in attorney's fees. On either side. I mean, that's true for the plaintiffs too, but it's still enough risk that people are put off by that. Now, as far as groups that are fighting, absolutely. They're in every one of these instances. I've mentioned a number of places where these, you know, the sort of attack on the individual for settlement money has been challenged by either law firms that are willing to take up the cause, legal organizations that are willing to take up the cause, or other groups or entities. But there are certainly people who are fighting on these things. It's a lot of fight.
Yeah, the general rule in American law is each side pays their own lawyers. There's the award of attorney's fees is not the norm. The deal about the copyright, stupid thing, sorry. Yeah. Copyright law is that there is a provision that attorney's fees can be awarded in certain circumstances. Same is true trademark law, too. I mean, any of these statutory schemes, there oftentimes is a provision about the award of fees. And to me, to be quite honest, sometimes the award of fees is greater, a greater threat of damages than the actual damages that somebody may have suffered, the actual monetary loss. On that note, there are two types of damages that copyright law provides for. You could get your actual damages, the amount you've lost or the amount they've made, the profits they've made, or you can get this number we've been talking about, up to $150,000. It varies depending, a little bit of factors go into it. That's called statutory damages. You don't have to prove anything, just that there was an infringement. And so that's the real power, these statutory damages that allow you to get these huge penalties, really, these huge fines, without having to show that you actually lost, you know, a dime from what took place.
I have a two-part question, and you already have sort of touched on one of them. A brief background on me. My background in copyright is I'm in the music industry. I'm a musician, and I have a label in Nashville, Tennessee. And the music industry, obviously, over the past 10 years has spent a lot of time digging a hole for itself and kind of destroying itself from within, like, with this whole idea of copyright litigation and what they've chosen to do with it. To me, it seems like a lot of the fundamental problem is we're working with a law that was written in 1976 that's based on a law that was written in 1909, and the speed of progress is just, we've just outpaced it, and we're dealing with definitions of things, and we're trying to, you know, sort of apply that that law to current day situations. And the first part of the question was, you know, is there any possibility we could revise that, which you had said no earlier. But and I know a lot of it is tied up in the fact that, you know, Disney is very powerful and Universal, and everyone who holds copyrights has a lot of money and has the power to sort of dictate what the terms are. But it's at the point, especially in the music industry, it's destroying progress. Like, we can't make any progress. Spotify took 3 years to get to the U.S. They're suing Grooveshark. They're suing companies that are trying to be legitimate and trying to operate within the scope of the law, and they're still getting sued. What's our options? Like, what can we do? Are we just doomed, or?
Write your congressman. Yeah. I mean, as far as that goes, let me just say that I don't want to say that there is no chance that copyright law will ever be amended. Will copyright law often be amended at the insistence of the big guys? Yeah, they've got more money, they've got more leverage. They call their congressman.
And write a check.
Right. What we were saying is there any way that there'll be a provision in copyright law that says, if you're just a little guy and you're not making a lot of money, it's okay to copy? No. but is there going to be some changes to copyright law to address the changing technology? Frankly, it's doing a phenomenal job of handling the technology for what it is. I mean, it is a law that was created in 1976, and yet we are still able to use large portions of it to cover major issues. That being said, it's going to have to change at some point. There's going to have to be revisions, amendments, slight changes to is there going to be a complete revamp of copyright law? No. I strongly doubt it. But is there going to have to be some changes made in the next 10 or 20 years? I can't imagine that the technology won't outstrip the ability. And just to burn my bridge at both ends, while I'm no big fan of RIAA, I also am not a big fan of the music downloads, because I think that also cripples the industry. I mean, from the artist's perspective, if I'm not making any money off of it, why am I going to make the product? I am a fan of copyright law. I believe that copyright law should exist. For no other reason than it pays my bills. But it needs to be there. It is something that encourages creation. But it needs to be there to encourage creation. That's its constitutional purpose. It shouldn't be there to discourage creation or stifle use.
Now, I take kind of an economic look at it, a stance with it. Technology is always going to outpace law, because the guys that write the laws just don't have that, you know, they're not futurists. They can't think of what, can't anticipate. And the best they can do is come up with a system that might cover future things by accident, not by design, probably. But the way I look at it is, if we're going to have to come up with new economic models, and I don't know what they are yet, but you know, you can see in the music business, at least, when Apple started doing downloads for 99 cents, I think that, from what I've read at least, the number of people downloading illegally dropped, because they, you know, if it's an amount people can handle or stomach or not feel like they're being ripped off, and it's convenient and it's easy. I mean, that's the success of Apple's business model. You just log. I don't use iTunes, so I'm just speaking from seeing my daughter do it. I go to Amazon because I don't want to have any of this DRM crap, and you know, I want to be able to do whatever I want to do with my MP3 file. But they have a beautiful business thing, because it's so easy. You just plug your little thing in and boom, it synchronizes and you download stuff. I mean, it's just elegant. When we get to that kind of thing, then I think that some of these concerns will drop away. If the New York Times or the big newspapers can figure out some way to sell their content online, and they're casting about furiously trying to find ways to do it. The New York Times this year is now keeping track of how many times your IP address, I guess, goes to their website, and if you go over 10 or 20, they'll send you a little thing saying, why didn't you sign up, because we won't let you go again and look at our stuff, unless you get it through Google or something. There are all these weird exceptions. You could, if you really wanted to be cheap and avoid it, you could get around it, but... I don't know. I mean, my hope is that this becomes. I'll put it this way: I would place more faith in this becoming irrelevant or minimized as a concern by the marketplace than I would over Congress ever fixing it. If I would bet on those two ponies. No, the stuff with all these Right Haven suits. If they wanted to get around it, the people who are posting these things, there's a simple solution. They just paraphrase what they've read. They rewrite it. And if they use only a small amount of an excerpt, I mean, you see that on more and more I've seen on web pages where they do quotes. They won't let you quote the whole thing. They'll tell you, you know, in your comments even, you can't do don't, if you quote over an X amount, we don't want it. We'll remove it from the Supreme Court. Gosh, I don't know when, in the Telegraph days, came out with a case, the U.S. Supreme Court came out with a case that allowed the hot news exception to copyright law. Because what publishers were going, or some newspapers were going and getting information that came over the Telegraph from another source and rewriting it and publishing it in their own thing. And the court said, you can't copyright facts. And if those are facts, then that's okay, as long as they don't copyright, as long as they don't take the expression of what you said, because copyright covers the expression of an idea, how you wrote it, how you put it together. So the way to beat Right Haven is to put a little effort in and paraphrase and do minimal quotes. if I were a web person, I'd want to educate myself on a good way to write a fair use response to them. If they send me one of their letters, I'd write back, you know, maybe pay a lawyer to write you just a general letter explaining, you know, a couple hundred bucks explaining what fair use is and, you know, putting it in context so you can say, we only used a small portion of your article and we did it for educational purposes and, you know, and we're not, you know, it's a nonprofit website or we're not making income from this, you know, something like that, and just send it back. If anybody pushes back against guys like Right Haven, they're going to go on to the next fish. They're going to go on to somebody else that's an easier target.
There's an even easier fix than that, actually. I mean, that's a way to get around it when you're posting. But a lot of these Right Haven suits, including this one that made all the headlines recently when Right Haven got kicked out for standing issues, were people posting on someone else's website. The Digital Underground, some user posted the Las Vegas Review or Denver Post or whoever's article on the digital, the Democratic Underground. Digital Underground, it's a very different thing. The Democratic Underground website. Well, that's fixed by having a DMCA agent.
Yeah, safe harbor.
Why did the agent word leave me? Yes. Now, if any of you have been here in the past and have seen me speak on the DMCA, it's a very lovely topic. We should talk about it in detail, but in a nutshell, there is a safe harbor provision that says if someone puts infringing material on your website and you have an agent for notice on file with the Copyright Office, it costs $150 to file, it's cheaper than the letter, then what Right Haven would have to do is notify that DMCA agent that its copyrighted material is on there. DMCA agent takes it down, problem solved. There is no lawsuit. There can't be any lawsuit. RIAA, Right Haven, MPAA, they're all one in my mind. Right Haven would be able to go and sue the guy who actually posted it up there if they could find that guy and find any actual contact information and bring a suit against him, which is about as likely as, me being able to drink water without spilling it all over the place. The reality is that if you have that DMCA agent, the Right Haven leverage goes away almost completely, because they don't have the ability to sue. If you take it down, you are 100% protected under the safe harbor.
But you've got to have that agent, and there have been people that have been popped because they didn't.
All of these, in all of these cases, in any of the ones where people have actually been sued, the 375 cases where Right Haven has brought someone into court, it's because they didn't have a DMCA agent for takedown notices, or if they did, they didn't properly comply with the takedown demand.
Well, and I don't think that's public knowledge, though, either, that people generally know that. So
you
pass
guys
it on.
Know.
Yeah.
Now you know you won't get sued by Right Haven. Tell your friends.
And you can, you know, this letter that I'm talking about, a response to Right Haven, I mean, it's out there. The people that get popped are the ones that don't make use of the internet to find information. I mean, it's a hassle. It's a pill to suddenly educate yourself on copyright law. But everybody in this room probably, you know, is capable of coming back to a Right Haven and saying, "I'm sorry, guys, you don't have a case, and you know, we'll fight it in under section, you know, 110 or 115 or whatever it is of a Copyright Act. We'll ask for attorney's fees because we think it's in bad faith." And I bet they go away, in most cases. The copyright law, I think, is interesting. It's fascinating to me because it can be used as a weapon. And a weapon for purposes other than what it was intended. You know, I'm sure most of you are familiar with, or a lot of you are familiar at least, with the concept of gray market goods, where somebody manufactures a product, say a watch, you know, a fancy Omega watch maybe, and they sell it in this country for lots of money. But they also sell it overseas, but you get it for less over there. So if somebody buys it over there and ships it here and then resells it here, it's what's called gray market, classified as gray market. It's not the company doesn't want you to import it, and you're not authorized to import it, but that you if you do so, it's in violation, and they contend of their rights, and they try to stop you because it hurts the price of it over here. Because actually, there was one case at the Ninth Circuit, I believe, where there was something that was sold really pricey over here, but it was sold just, you know, as a perfume or something. It was sold in, you know, drugstores in Europe for a heck of a lot less. And so they didn't want the cheap stuff coming over here because it was the same stuff. The reason I say that is there was a case decided recently, I guess it was by the Ninth Circuit, and then the Supreme Court split 4-4, which means that they didn't overrule the Ninth Circuit. The ruling below stood. They didn't have the full nine members of the court because Justice Kagan, the newest justice, had to recuse herself because she was the Solicitor General, urging the Supreme Court not to take the case. But anyway, the whole thing was based on a watch that had a logo on the back side of the watch that was copyrighted. And they were using the Copyright Act to say, it's complicated, but to say that by bringing in their watch with this logo on it into this country, it was not a right of first sale, or
first sale rights.
Yeah, right of first sale, which gets into some technical stuff in the Copyright Act. But anyway, they're basically saying you're violating our copyright, selling a watch, but because of the silly logo on the back of the watch, I think. They were saying that was a violation of their copyright. And the Ninth Circuit agreed and said, you can't import this. The guy that imported it, you're violating their copyright. So you are liable for infringing their copyright, even though they made the damn watch. He didn't make knockoffs. It was their watch. It just was one that they sold elsewhere, not for sale in the U.S. So, I mean, it could be used as a powerful tool, once again, because of it has all these tremendous penalty provisions that have been ramped up by the groups that really want to use, you know, the penalty.
There was a case like that actually even much earlier, yeah, probably 25 or 30 years ago, was shampoo. There was some very expensive shampoo, which clearly I'm not very knowledgeable on, but... they brought it in. They imported it in a gray market scenario. They had gray market goods. There was nothing they could say about it. It was the shampoo. They were selling the shampoo. There was no misrepresentations. But they stopped the sale of the shampoo in this country by saying that the shampoo bottle, with the language on the back of the shampoo bottle about how it will make your hair lustrous and shiny, was infringing their copyright, because that was their copyrighted content. And it was successful. It doesn't have to be great expression. It just has to be an expression. Harvey Birdman.
Thank you. I was wondering if anybody else got that.
If that's the case, then how can I even buy a bottle of shampoo without getting a copy of a license to keep it in my house that they're intellectual material?
You don't do that as a matter of course?
I get that letter with every bottle.
Yeah.
Well, when you buy shampoo and you go to the store or the salon or wherever it is you buy your shampoo, because I can't see your hair, for all I know you don't have any. When you go and buy shampoo, it's being sold through a real my tongue is just not working today. I have a retailer who is authorized to sell it by the shampoo company. So when you go and buy Johnson & Johnson products at Target or Walmart or Walgreens or wherever you're buying your Johnson & Johnson product, Johnson & Johnson has said, that's okay. I'm selling you an American-branded product here that I'm allowing Walmart to retail to you, and you are buying it as an authorized consumer. The problem becomes when Johnson & Johnson sells some product in Poland that they don't sell here. You really want that Polish shampoo because it's fantastic for your hair. You want to import that Polish shampoo and sell it to other people so they'll know how great it is for your hair. Well, you're not an authorized Johnson & Johnson retailer. You're not supposed to be selling this Polish shampoo here in the United States. Maybe it's not even approved for sale in the United States. That's where the problem comes in. And if there's no way for me to stop you from selling it otherwise, then I fall back on the, you're infringing my copyright because my expression is on the bottle and you're selling it.
I think the answer is you don't. You don't know if it's, I mean, if you buy a really good deal on a computer, could be that it's, you know, 47th Street Photo in New York used to have sell all sorts of stuff. Any of those big photo places in New York City, and a lot of them were gray market goods. You know, if they give you a clue like, may come with plug adapter for U.S. plugs, that's probably a sign you're buying a gray market something or other. But, you know, they're going out the importers. They're not going after the purchaser.
Well, right. Well, how long before they are?
Well, too much money. Remember, it's this cost, this burden. You know, they go against you and say, well, first of all, you're not selling the product.
Right, but when you download, you're not selling it either.
Well, but you're using it. I mean, it affects the market.
I use a shampoo.
They're not going to go after you for the shampoo.
You may start getting it. If there's some shampoo collective that could start making money off of it and send demands to see what's in your shower, sure. If someone could figure out a way to use the RIA technology, the mechanism that they've developed to create a profit to target shampoo end users, they probably would.
Yeah, if it sold for $1,000 a bottle, that'd be the incentive. If it sells for $5 a bottle, just not there.
Yeah, but this is a bit of a technical question. So right now, the hip new thing on technology nowadays, the cloud computing, where you have a data and then you make a backup of data on different computers everywhere. Mm-hmm. So say I have a server in the United States and then I have a server at some other country, so say Poland, and then I apparently infringe some copyright materials that I have on my server, which is both in the United States and Poland. And how does this work? How does this whole thing work? I mean, do they have to sue you twice in different countries, or what's going on?
They don't have to sue you at all. If they want to sue you, they could probably sue you in either country if that's where your content was. In some respects, it's going to be difficult to classify, so they're probably going to where the content is. So they're probably going to target you where the harm was caused. In other words, if they're a Polish company and they want to sue you over there, they will. If you're an American company, they'll sue you over here. Where you are is going to be a large part of where they would choose to sue you. But the idea of cloud computing doesn't necessarily create new venue questions. It may create access to venues that weren't there before in some respects. But more likely than not, you're just going to have your traditional venue of where's the defendant at this point, and that's where you're going to get hit.
That's an example of where the copyright law tried to keep up with technology. It allows you to make a backup copy of a program you buy or something you buy. It allows you to make a copy. The Betamax case allowed you to make a video of something that was broadcast over the air.
What's that?
Sorry. gosh, how do I describe Betamax? a copy of something that was broadcast to watch later. It was time shifting that was permitted according to the Supreme Court. With cloud computing, the difference between me making a backup copy on a flash drive or a hard, on a floppy or something like that. With cloud computing, it all goes somebody else's computer. You don't even own the computer. You're just using their storage space. Well, there was somebody recently that tried to do a music service where they wanted you to upload all your music to them, to their servers, and then they would let you listen to it anywhere you could access the internet. I think that the record industry said, no, you can't do that, because they were afraid that you'd get, it'd start sharing the songs that you had. And I don't know what the status of that one, but it's an interesting idea, and it's based on the notion of, well, you can back up your stuff. You can back it up over the internet to somebody else's server, to Apple, Amazon or Apple's iCloud or something like that. What's the problem with that? Well,
but again, looking at strict interpretation of copyright law, I do a lot of gaming law, video gaming, not gambling gaming. It's such a confusing area. And one of the things that has come out of that particular arena, particularly in licensing fights and copying fights there, is that it is now very well established that every time your computer runs a piece of software, it's creating a copy. So I've got the CD. I put it in my computer. I've made a copy of that CD. Now, in most cases that's permissible, but it is deemed to be a copy. And that goes for, you put it on the cloud, you put it on another, you copy from one CD to another. You're making copies in all of these in all of these situations. So from a purely, just strictly academic perspective, you are infringing copyright every single time you do. And you turn your computer on, you've infringed 45 copyrights. The difference is that you have the right to do that. You've been given a permission to do that by the person who sold you the product. So that's where technology is really going to start to become a problem, is what happens when I put your disk in my computer? What happens when, you know, I have some way of accessing your cloud drive? That's something that, well, we'll wait and see what happens when they get around to changing the copyright law, if they ever do.
The case with the MP3s was mp3tunes.com. And the court result, I believe, was that if there was a master recording that was being replayed to different people, that was wrong. But if it was kept a separate copy each time, mm-hmm. that was acceptable. And yeah. that came down, mm-hmm. I think, last week.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
And that's the copying has always been allowed. Home copying, there's a home copying exception. I can, if I buy a record or a tape or a CD, I'm allowed to copy it. I'm allowed to give you that copy. That's something that's permissible under copyright law. It becomes a problem, and it's become a big problem for music companies when, instead of me sitting there and having to pull out my old, you know, dual cassette deck and make a copy of a tape, and your copy sounds terrible, when I'm able to make 100 million copies instantaneously and send them to people I don't know. And that's the technology difference that's creating all of the MP3 hoopla. But that's simply a matter of scale, and that's what the cases are looking at.
I want to get back to the point about your shampoo hypothetical, the question. And there was a case that came out of the Ninth Circuit, I believe, last month, called Kurtzang, which dealt with, and this is just illustrative for everybody's edification, you had someone who was purchasing books that were made in Asia and offered 8 books for sale on eBay. And Kurtzang, I think, is the person who was doing that, actually lost in the Ninth Circuit, and the award to the plaintiff was $600,000 for 8 books. So, you know, yeah, your point is well taken about the $5 shampoo, but then again, when statutory damages are involved and you have some really, I mean, borderline insane case law on the first sale doctrine, you know, there are things that people should be aware of, and right now, the law of the land, I think people need to question, you know, when they start selling things they've owned to other people secondhand, right now they kind of have to look at, okay, do I know where this was made, and do I have, you know, is there some sort of implicit permission for me to sell this to another person?
Well, I think the point we're making is that they're going after the importer who's trying to resell the goods rather than the end user. They're not looking at the guy who bought that one book necessarily. They're looking at the guy who's trying to sell the books, just like they're not looking at someone washing their hair. They're looking at the person selling the shampoo. But that's absolutely true. The first sale doctrine is a very hairy area, especially when you start dealing with technology, because there's a lot of conflicting case law about what do you own when you buy a software program, when you buy any software. Microsoft will tell you that you don't own your copy of Office, you license it. So you don't have the ability to transfer it. You can't sell your copy of Word to me because it's a license. That's a breach of your license agreement. Courts have found different results on that. Some courts will say that no, you have all the rights and incidents of ownership, and therefore it's ownership. You own that software. You can do with it whatever you want, just like it was a used book or a used record.
But going back to topic,
otherwise.
Sorry.
Nope, go ahead.
I was just say, going back to topic, though, what you said about the damages that were awarded to whichever in the party is exactly why Right Haven has turned out to be a good business model. Because people looked at that and went, I could pay them $5,000 or I'm looking at $150 plus.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, it was a good business model, just not very well thought out.
Right. We really are sounding pro-Right Haven. I don't know if that's a good...
We've convinced her.
I think he was a really savvy businessman to the extent that he went, wait, I can find the dollar in that mess, but he didn't do a very good job of collecting beyond that.
Well, as a lawyer, I appreciate the cleverness, in a sense, of, certainly the case where they went on the trademark cases, the cases where they use copyright law to try to keep gray market goods out. I thought, well, you know, I first heard about that, that's a lousy thing to do, and then I thought about it a little more and thought, but that's a clever thing to do, you know, and you kind of appreciate the Right Haven model, you know, it's people who copy whole articles and stick them in, you know, they need to modify what their practice is, and, you know, I'm not defending those guys at all, but, you know, it's kind of a clever way to make some money.
And the avoidance factor is creative writing 101.
Yeah.
Or a DMCA agent. Or both.
I have a question with regards to, it's very similar to what this gentleman asked about having a cloud server here and then somewhere in another country. Let's say that you have a bunch of CDs, you had them for years, you bought them legally, there's no right of first sale issue. You rip them into MP3s, you upload them to a cloud drive, you have no idea, you're using some random service, they have a bunch of servers, you have no idea where they are, they're just an address that you type into your address bar. But they happen to be on a server farm in a jurisdiction or in a circuit that has very good rulings in favor of sort of, you know, the plaintiffs in these sorts of lawsuits. What are the odds that they can pull you into court? Like, does that count as having substantial contact
with
that form?
Where do you live?
Okay, so that will still control.
Sure.
All right.
Well, that's a big part of it. Now, will they pull you into that jurisdiction where they have a very pro plaintiff ruling? Yes. Will they be able to keep you there? Is a different question.
I think you made a pro defense ruling, didn't you? Good jurisdiction for anyway.
Well, if where you live is very pro-defendant and you'd probably win, and where your music is stored is very pro-plaintiff and you'd probably lose, you're going to get sued where your music is. You can then get an attorney, and if your attorney is good, he will be able to be, well, I don't want to say will be, but may be able to be successful in getting you removed back to your jurisdiction. But are they going to sue you there? Yes.
Yeah. Because the burden's on you. Unless it's just totally frivolous. If they've got a basis at all to say, well, that's where the injury occurred, or that's where the wrong is done, the infringement occurred, then they're going to go for the best jurisdiction they can. And just as long as they have some thread to put it on so they won't get into too much trouble.
But can you be set up purposely avail yourself of that forum if you didn't even know you were going to have your music in that service?
Well, that's the argument your attorney would make.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, that's what it's going to come down to is can you get an attorney who can make a successful argument to transfer the venue to where you believe you ought to be? And that's going to be depending on the facts of your case and what's actually happening. It's also going to depend on how good your attorney is, but it's going to be an argument you're going to have to make at your expense in that pro-plaintiff jurisdiction.
And it depends on how you're viewed by the fact finder, the decision maker, the judge, whatever. If they think what you did was wrong on some fundamental level, you're going to have an uphill climb. You know, they're going to, you know, the reason Right Haven get popped in so many of these cases, well, not so many, but in all these cases getting popped more and more for bringing a frivolous suit in one of them where they made him pay the other guy's attorney's fees is because they looked at what Right Haven was doing and it just had a bad smell about it.
For copyrighted works, how well protected are you when you go to edit a copyrighted work? Like we said, you could paraphrase.
What do you mean, edit somebody else's work?
Yeah, for, say, personal use or fair use. The case that comes to mind is Sony and Geohots.
I beg your pardon?
Sony versus Geohots. It was a case where he was unlocking the rootkit for PlayStation.
Okay. The problem with that is what we were discussing earlier was the factual inclusion, being able to take a news article. Whitehaven has a problem that it's trying to protect news, and the news isn't something that you can own. You can't own the facts. You can't own the ability to tell the facts of what happened in any given news story. All you can protect is the expression of how you've reported those facts. So when you copy whatever the Los Angeles Review or the Denver Post or the New York Sun or anybody else has put into their newspaper, you're copying their expression. But there's nothing in the world that will stop you from saying, these are the facts of a news story. So rewriting or re-editing what you wanted to include as the facts of that news story is a way to avoid a Whitehaven suit, because you're not copying the expression and the facts aren't protectable. When you get into different types of works, more creative works, there's a lot more protection that can go to the plot of a novel than into the content of a news story. There's a lot more protection to the characters in a movie than to the actors in a crime that's reported in the news. So that's where the distinction is going to be drawn, and how much you can change and how much you can edit and how differently you can tell the story. You know, that's an open question. That's Romeo and Juliet versus West Side Story.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, although Romeo and Juliet had long passed out of copyright.
Well, right.
You can't take a copyrighted work, or not a fictional work, and paraphrase it and do anything with it. That's a derivative work. That's a right that original creator had. Fan fiction sites, that's copyright infringement all over the place. Now they don't go against them because it actually probably helps the market, you know, it helps their fans, and they don't want to. But every fan fiction site in the world, as far as I can tell, is a copyright. It's a derivative work based on somebody else's creative work. It's infringement.
Yeah, but every piece of writing that's out there is basically plagiarism on someone else's ideas or previous writings.
You can't protect the idea. Some things have more originality than others. I mean, something that it's hard to get copyright on something that's not. It's hard to win a case. If you have something that's just mundane, a greeting card, for example, it's hard. And somebody comes up with a similar greeting card, you'd have a hard time to say, you know that the way I said happy birthday is protected. Right. The courts, you know, there's a level of come on now.
And you can certainly go write a story about some guy who fights crime in the city. You can write a story about some guy who fights crime using gadgets in the city. You can probably even write a story about some guy who dresses as a nocturnal mammal and fights crime using gadgets in the city. But the more layers you add to that, and the closer you get to Batman, the more likely you're going to get sued.
It's actually specifically relating to this topic, but kind of going back to music. I know with music, in determining the amount that you can copy, I've heard that it's been getting a lot shorter and shorter in terms of like, oh, if you have a sequence of these so many notes that are similar, then that's an infringement. And I've heard a lot of people complain that that's a problem, just because the more music you have, the harder and harder it is truly to create a sequence of notes people like that aren't also similar to other notes you've seen. Do you have any like cases or ideas about that specific topic?
No, because there really isn't one. I mean, the fact is that in some cases, two or three identifiable notes are going to absolutely get you hammered if you're in front of the right judge on the right day. And in some cases, the entire, 12 bars of something are going to be deemed de minimis. And a lot of it depends on the judge, a lot of it depends on the facts, a lot of it depends on how you're using the music. But there really has never been a clear-cut standard for how much is okay to infringe. And I don't think there ever will be, because once you say it's okay to take this much, well, then people are just going to start pushing on the edges of that. And it's going to come. It's always going to be a moving target. So when you get into the idea of sampling, which is where this comes out a lot, how much of it you're going to take, the idea of sampling is, well, you can do it at your own risk. And it's probably okay because they're probably not going to sue. But if they do, you copied it. So, you know, what do you do?
There have been sampling cases where people got popped for sampling.
Mm-hmm. Well, and sometimes it's not even sampling, though. Honestly, there are collisions right. where they can be like, no, this is just an accident.
Well, it's not like patent law. You copyright, you patents, you come up with the idea, you own that idea, even if somebody else came up with the idea independently of yours, as long as you get there and file it and get it approved first. Copyright law protects your expression of your idea. If I, in my own little room, never hearing your song, come up with a song that's 90% similar, as long as we didn't hear each other or are word fluenced by each other, my expression is protected too. It's not an infringement. It's not an infringement. It's only for infringement, you have to show basically access to somebody else's work. J.K. Rowling was sued for somebody that said, "Oh, but they stole her story about." You've heard of her, Harry Potter, perhaps. Somebody here probably has this Dragon Con. They stole her story about a youthful wizard. Well, she's basically, I think she won by saying, "I'd never heard that story,"
right.
And they showed that, you know, it was published, you know, in 1,000 books and wasn't sold anywhere. You know, it was just the likelihood. It was a very similar story, perhaps, or had similar components, but that she did not infringe because she didn't know about it.
So what about Men at Work with the Kookaburra song?
Well, see, that's an interesting one because the question is, did they intentionally copy it or not? And I think they kind of admitted they did, which is a part of the problem. But the Men at Work case is really just a modern retelling of the George Harrison My Sweet Lord case. Problem is that George Harrison thinks he wrote that song.
Yeah.
George Harrison is convinced he wrote My Sweet Lord. The court, on the other hand, thinks he copied He's So Fine.
Yeah.
And the court decided that by saying He's So Fine was a really popular song. It was really it was played on the radio all over the place. You know, it was just part of your subconscious. And as you sat down and wrote this song, you put it together. It sounds just like My Sweet Lord because subconsciously you were thinking about He's So Fine when you were making it. And that's the same thing that they really came out with on Men at Work, was that it was subliminal copying. It was just a popular Australian kids song, and you knew it, you thought of it, you got up there, you did a little flute solo, and it happened to be the kids song that you've known for a long time. Now, subsequently, I think they said that they intentionally put it in there because they thought it'd be, you know, very reflective of Australia, as that song was supposed to be, but even if it was unintentional, even if it was subliminal, they can show that if you're from Australia, you know the Kookaburra song. You're going to get hit with copyright infringement, whether you did it on purpose or not. That's a really slippery area. Anybody?
I actually had a question.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I heard about a lawsuit.
run!
I heard about a lawsuit between eBay and I think it was Amazon. I'm not entirely sure. But basically, the copyright law infringement was on process. eBay has copyrighted a lot of the way of how the bidding works and how the. But it's also literally like how the code. The infringement was basically like some sort of business process copyright infringement, and I didn't really understand what that meant because, as far as I know, Ford's assembly line system was not copyrightable because it was a concept, not an actual written material.
I think it's patent. I don't think copyright would apply unless they stole the computer code or something like that, but. I don't know what you're talking about, but Ford's assembly line system used to not be able to get patents for business processes, I think. It's something like that.
Yeah, now you can.
And they changed that.
Olds patented it in 1901.
I beg your pardon?
Olds patented it in 1901.
Well, the business process, but building a car. Well, building
a
car.
Assembly line building. Well, patented by Olds before
okay.
Ford.
Well, there are some things, at least with a lot of computer programs and some processes, accounting worksheets and
Ford
things like that.
Things?
Couldn't be patented. But then the law has evolved, and now they allow patents on all sorts of things, which is why the cell phone companies are the cell phone and manufacturers and Google are battling each other over patent rights, over whether you know, being able to use your finger on a screen, or are Apple suing Samsung, I guess, because they have a slate computer, you know, and Samsung's response is, have you ever seen 2001 A Space Odyssey? Or have you ever seen Star Trek? You know, they use slate computers. I mean, you guys, you didn't come up with the idea of a slate for a computer.
Yeah, I guess my follow-up question is when, it's kind of a little bit off the topic, but when it does sort of apply when what made me think about it was you talked about the telegraph when you're reporting facts, okay? It makes me think about the same thing. There's only so many ways that you can do something.
Jack.
And so that I don't quite understand how that could be patented or copyrighted at all, because there's only so many ways you can write code. Now, literally taking someone's code, right, and using it and selling it, that's copyright. I'm right. Good with that. But the process of how it works, you know, you have a shopping cart, you put items in it, you make a purchase. There's only so many ways you can do that.
Well, the problem with that is that as long as you're independently creating the code, if the code comes out to be pretty similar because you're doing pretty similar things, you're gonna have a defense on that. But if you do what people often do in the programming industry, not that any you guys would ever do this, but there's a lot of borrowing in the programming industry. Because the reality is, a lot of programmers have a very open source mindset. You know, you make something, it works great, let's let everybody use it. And the problem is, a lot of programmers feel that way. A lot of the companies that programmers work for don't feel that way. And so that could be, you know, an area where there is an issue, is if you are borrowing someone else's code, then you're committing copyright infringement. If you're just generally coming up with the same sorts of commands because you're using the same language and you're trying to achieve the same end, then you're going to end up that way. Patents, you can protect the idea. You can stop somebody else from using the most basic concept, but it's because you can only do it for a very, very limited time.
Which is getting longer than it used to be. I mean, it's like copyright. They've expanded the time.
Yeah, I just recently read a patent on toasting bread.
I read a patent on somebody who sold prepackaged peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. A patent.
Yeah.
Patents are supposed to be novel, not suggested by the prior, you know, by prior art and some other things. I think our patent system is broken, and you got these people who are patent examiners in D.C. and Virginia who don't understand programming, and they'll get something in and they'll go, well, okay, I guess that's, they can't find the prior art. There's somebody else doing it before, so which kills the idea of, you've come up with this thought originally, you're the first one to come up with it, it hasn't been released in the public domain. Well, there are all sorts of internet bloggers and types who go out and try to find prior art for things like Apple saying, we invented the slate computer. You know, we invented the concept of using a tablet for a computer. You know.
All right. Well, we're clearly being ejected. And I'm not sure that we talked about much involving Right Haven, but hopefully we talked about a lot involving copyright law. It was interesting, and you guys had a good time. So, any other questions, come see us outside, because we got to go.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Are you one of those other panels? I don't really see this.